towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. So for the benefit of those listening to the recording, we're at Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri, and we have sort of official military helicopters flying very low. We think they're documenting us, so just be prepared. You'll find us on, maybe on the news, who knows. But that's what the sound is in the background. Shall I review the highlights again from the last few days? Is that helpful?
Yes.
So again, pop quiz. Murshid said that we're likened to light because the soul is the
glow.
The glow. The mind is the
flame.
The body is the
end
of the flame. The heat is the
atmosphere,
and the smoke is, could be obscurations, or it's fuel, but it's also can be smoke that can obscure the light a bit. So we have to recognize whether how we're using the fuel. And I actually have something at the end of class to read to you that was very beautiful, that came sort of seemingly randomly, but there are no random incidences really, but it relates to that. And then Murshid emphasized on day one that as different lights differ in their degree of radiance, so do different souls. The substance of each person, however, is the same light. It's the same, but it's a matter of what we're tuned to and what we're tuned to in the moment. And again, I mentioned the papers, so many of you are connected to the Rouhaniyat, the Sufi Rouhaniyat International, that on MurshidSam.org there are papers, and the one Culture on Breath can talk about that, and also the Jalal and Kamalic breaths that help us tune and know how much of that light to give out at any given moment. And then Murshid talked about the signs of spirituality, and he said health of body, the balance of the mind, and purity of the soul all depend upon the radiance of our being. And he reminds us that having a healthy body is spiritual, a balanced mind is spiritual, purity of the soul is spiritual. These are all the signs. A good atmosphere, power of the word, courage without fear, fearlessness, self-confidence, the capability to accomplish something. And I don't think that's always an external goal, but it can be training the mind or taming the mind in some way. You know, there's something that keeps coming up, and how many times do I want to fall in that hole? You know, can I be diligent to watch when it arises? And what are the means? Are there exercises, spiritual practices available to me? You know, Sogyal Rinpoche, who a lot of you might know, he wrote the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and many other things. I mean, a great, great Rinpoche. And he would always say that the mantra is the great seal on the mind. So if you don't know what else to do, use a sacred phrase or a sacred word. It can change the atmosphere, and really concentrate on that within. I love the Lojong saying, you know, instead of just keep spiraling into it, it says do something different. Do something different. So, you know, what is that? Instead of just sitting there going over and over again, you know, go use the energy of it to clean out a drawer or closet even. Do something productive with the energy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to... It's like, okay, I'm going to pull those weeds. and the strength of struggling all along through life. So no one said it was going to be a bed of roses. In a bed of roses, there are a lot of thorns. There are a lot of thorns. But also, my gosh, how strong does that make us? You know, and I don't need to remind you, but I will, of that beautiful Buddhist teaching about the thorns, you know, walking on thorns, that we could spend a lot of energy plucking the thorns out, and that's this person that irritates me, or this circumstance that I don't like, or, you know, whatever, even a part of ourselves. Or we can just reinforce the soles of our feet with really good shoes, good soles. That's, of course, our practice. Our practice is that for us. Fortifies us. It gives us strength and courage. So that was day two. And then day three, which was yesterday, was so that we were just talking about the signs of spirituality, and yesterday was the purpose of life. And the purpose of life of an individual is to perfect the light within. Now, really, every one of us have it. What is it, and how do you give it to the world? Don't hide your light under a bushel. And here's another really great secret. Do you want it? Okay. Think about it as a current or a transmission. Okay, when something's transmitting, it's sending a message out, isn't it? What happens to the messages that are out there? Do they get in?
Not always.
Not always. So, if you feel like you're being bombarded by the world or circumstances or people, things, impressions, radiate. Allow your radiance to go out and touch the atmosphere. Instead of sending out judgment, which is natural for us to do, and it certainly protects us. I think I try to call it discriminating wisdom instead of judgment. Radiate love or radiate peace, and do your very best to pray for those that offend you. Because if they knew better, they probably wouldn't do it. You also don't have to constantly expose yourself to abuse. So while you can distance yourself, that's discriminating wisdom. It's not judgment. And you can pray for them and radiate love, peace, whatever they need, compassion. Murshid also teaches the most sacred... Oh, no, I want to read this first. The question and answer part, and then I want to go back. Question. Is love for one's neighbor not sufficient to help another? He was talking about hope, and if someone becomes hopeless, or if someone needs help, or how can we share our light? You know, that expression, no candle becomes less bright for having lit another, you know. No candle becomes less bright for having lit another. So the question is love for one's neighbor not sufficient to help? And the answer is, love is the substance. By self-confidence, one makes that substance. And by the power of self-confidence, one is able to impart that. For instance, if one sees a person who is very ill and thinks, what can I do? How can I do something? Then one can do nothing. For healing, it is all confidence that is needed for healing oneself and for healing another. Not only for healing, but for all things, in business, in industry, in work. Self-confidence is necessary. Okay, now, I just want to say here that I believe it is our sacred duty to be viable contributors to society. We need to figure out how to earn enough for ourselves and some extra to help others that are less fortunate. Having money is not something that we shouldn't attain to. It is not evil in and of itself. It's energy. and we can use it for good purposes. I remember when I asked my Rinpoche, I was prepared to not come back from India. I was going to just be at the monastery, not necessarily a monk or nun. I integrated very well just as a lay person. But Rinpoche said, no, you go back to America. He said, you have a good living, and he felt that good professions were where we were teaching or helping people, like a doctor or teacher of some kind. And he said, it's a very good profession, and what's more is you can earn good money to help yourself, and you can help others with that money. You know, so the act of generosity is very big in Tibetan Buddhism. We don't talk about that very much in this tradition. But having been raised Catholic, we always tithed. We were expected to tithe to the church a certain percentage of our income. So giving is a way to receiving. I can't tell you how many times I would, when I was in graduate school, I was so skinny when I was in college because I had no money and I had to get myself through school, and so I would sacrifice food for my projects, and people often thought I was anorexic, you know. And sometimes I didn't have very much money. I had so little money. I mean, I made a little bit. I was teaching and things, but then as a graduate student especially, and I would put my money in four envelopes, and that would be all the money I could have for that week. And at the end, you know, of course, I'd go to Mass, and I always give. And then it was unbelievable how, you know, in a pocket I'd find 20 bucks or someone would take me. I mean, it always worked out somehow. I mean, God does provide, you know. God does provide. And then Murshid talks about this self-confidence and this love. And he says, in the Sufi terminology, it's called iman, I-M-A-N, iman. And he says, it is the most sacred thing in the whole religion. Self-confidence is the secret to all miracles. Here's another good thing. Whatever is going on in your life, you must never be ashamed. It is a great opportunity for your growth. If you don't share those things with your teachers, they can't help you. Don't feel, oh, I can't tell them that this thing's happened, or that I feel I've made this error, or I did this, you know, whatever it is, share it. Your teachers are teachers because they're not judging you, they're loving you, and they have some medicine that can help you. I can't tell you how many myriads of other people will come and tell me things that they won't tell their own teacher. It's like, well, have you talked to your teacher? Oh, no, I don't want to tell them that that's going on. That's what they can help you. I mean, they're not your psychotherapist or anything, but if they'll sympathize, not in a way that will bring you down and they'll get in there with you, but a way that hopefully can uplift you or show you another aspect of that situation and the value of it. And there are practices. I'm living proof. I've had serious disease in my body that they thought would be incurable. I didn't believe them. I rejected that. I'm not saying that disease, it was of value to me. It taught me something. A rare blood disease. By now, I should be crawling on the floor in a wheelchair. It's gone. No one can say why. I know. I believed that I could be better. It wasn't my time to die. There's going to be a time to die. There's going to be a time to let go. There's going to be a time of illness. The other great secret is, if you're in pain, don't try to get away from the pain. You have to go to the center of the pain. It's like being at the eye of the hurricane or the tornado. There's the great stillness. Pain is your meditation partner. It's your dharma buddy. It helps you concentrate. Whether it's in the body, it's in the head, it's in the heartbreak. I learned from a woman in Turkey last summer, by the way, clove. Chewing on a clove is good for heartbreak. If you have a heartache from someone hurt you, take a little clove and keep it in your mouth. It's good for the breath, too. Very practical. Mershad also talks about don't give up hope. Whatever you have, and there might be times, you know, there are times. When I was told when I was young that there was this rare disease that couldn't do anything about, I had it felt like a very black cloud over me for a while. Like, oh, you know, and then I thought, no, you know, I can learn from this, I can grow from this, and you know, I knew there was something in me that said, this is not my time to deal with this. It may come back around, and it may be my time, and that's okay too. Everything, isn't that beautiful quote, everything has a season, turn, yeah, it's beautiful. Call me, I know how to. When my mom was diagnosed a second time with cancer, I said to her, wait, you have a choice, Mom. Do you want to go lay on the couch or in bed and just die? Or do you want to get up and let's go have some fun? Mm-hmm. She had fun 15 years. Mm-hmm. With an incurable cancer, can you imagine? In the stomach. Anything's possible. Nothing's impossible. That's also a good thing if you can try to have fun. Whatever makes you feel happy, do it. And don't worry about what other people are thinking. Mershad told us in this teaching too, just do your best. And remember the advice of Maggie Sabato. I can repeat it again after the recording's out. My mama. Very practical advice. She gave that many times to people. Okay. So, day 4. Our last day this round, and hopefully we'll be gathering many, many times. We have miles to go before we sleep. Okay. So again, it's on the subject, Sufi Message Volume 8 from the Orange Volumes, The Privilege of Being a Human Being, Man, Woman is Likened to Light is the subject, and this chapter is on Fuel for the Light. Good subject for leaving Sufi camp on, right? Okay. As every light needs fuel, and Rabia gave us the really wonderful little lesson that Mershad was quoting from Matthew about the 10 virgins, 5 of them not preparing their lamps properly, and 5 of them putting oil in their lamp and placing their wick ready to meet the bridegroom. And the ones that didn't do it wanted the ones that did to help them out. And it was like, you didn't prepare. Too bad. You're not going to get to meet the bridegroom. So that's how we are too. It may take us a while. And then also remember what Mershad tells us about heaven. Whatever we haven't worked out here with the people that are here, they're going to be following us around in heaven too. So you might as well just work it out. If there's something that you feel you just can't get over, you really talk to a doctor, not just your guides. Sometimes there's something chemical in us that's not balanced. That can happen from stress or if someone's going through periods of hardship where they're maybe not sleeping well or eating properly. That's something that can be temporary or long term. It's okay. If you were a diabetic, you'd take insulin. If you had heart trouble, you'd take that. I know that also. I mean, we had that illness in our family. And medication ripped the veil that was the problem for the person. Sometimes it takes that. Not just because it's a little rough patch in the road, but if it's something long term, it's better to deal with it and get some help. It shouldn't be a shameful thing. One can be a wonderful example for others who need that help and encourage them as well. You know, it doesn't have to be labeled as mental or emotional illness. The body does weird things. We know that. Get that straightened out too. Hormonally, certainly for women, if you're suddenly getting depression, get your thyroid checked. Both men and women, it can happen. Loss of energy, loss of interest in life, tiredness, anger, you know, those things, the body sometimes is just messed up and it needs some correction. So fuel for the light. As every light needs fuel, so light, which is ours, which is ourself, needs fuel also. The fuel for the physical part of our life is what we call food. For life of the mind, intellectual substance is necessary. But if the body is fed and the mind is not, then naturally that light becomes less. The substance of the soul is the divine ideal, which is both love and light. There's that phrase again. I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. So, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm always thinking ahead, and I thought a good subject might also be, I try to attune to the theme of the camp, so it was radiance, but I also thought, I'm thinking it may be very important to talk about that divine ideal. What is our ideal? It may be one of the future camps. You know, Murshid gives these papers on building that ideal. That can also give us strength and sustenance, and it can be the accomplishment of a goal. Yeah? So stay tuned, Will. The sustenance of the soul is the divine ideal, which is both love and light. If the soul does not receive that nourishment, which is necessary for it, then the soul is starved. The body may be nourished, but it is not sufficient. That is why we see before our physical eyes many famine-stricken souls. But if we saw with the spiritual eyes, we would still see more famine in humanity. You know, this isn't just the food, but it's knowledge, it's intellectual stimulation, it's that thing that does lift people up. Example, I have a good friend. He is a living part of design history. I mean, he's in the books. He's so intelligent and he is so talented, and he's my senior, but we still are in communication. And you know, and there is a reason for this. He grew up and his father was one of those physicians during Nazi Germany. And you know, it changed him at a young age, imagine. So he lost faith then, and he never quite regained it. You know, when you see those things, it's like, how can God let this happen? Well, we see it from a certain perspective, but then what's God's view on it? You know? So anyway, he's a person that he feels he doesn't have faith. He can believe in his own mind. He can believe in his own, body and his own accomplishments. But as he has gotten older, he started really searching because he realized it wasn't enough. His soul is missing something. He has started to find it in nature. He has a beautiful home in outside of Boston. And, you know, it's like, well, feel the trees, you know, feel the beauty of the nature, that there's something in that for you. You know, it's Taoist in a way, right? It's just experience or the nature meditation. So it's like whenever he needs a little jolt of something, we have long conversations. And so we can be that for people too. We can be an example that can uplift people or help them start to search. So, you know, the question becomes too, when we have the eyes to see it, I mean, you don't have to go very far. One of the things that I do, Karima Gita knows this, and you all might think I'm very silly, but I get up very early in the morning with my husband. We go to sleep early too. We go to sleep at like 8:30 or 9, and we get up early. And then I turn on BBC News, and I do my practices, watching about the refugee camps, watching about the problems in Europe, watching about the economic situation, watching, you know, and I think all of those situations need love and light. And I need understanding so that I don't become discouraged and I don't become hopeless. So I'll do my practice. Then I go and walk the dogs and I do my practice in the neighborhood while we're circumambulating, you know. And we're not big gardeners. Joe says I have eternals because the poor bees, they come up to the plants and the flowers and they're trying to get something. And, you know, it's artificial flowers, so they always look great. But I have a lot of people in my neighborhood that are, you know, they're gardeners and they're even, like, doing those planting boxes. And it's like, what is this? Is this, you know, Midtown Kansas City starting to be farmland, you know? But I enjoy it. You know, I kind of participate and talk to them and I can witness it. And I go by and I thank people, like, thank you so much for the energy. I've really enjoyed your garden. And, you know, and then I also say, you better be careful. You better pick all those tomatoes and lettuce because that might be disappearing too. But you'll know where to come. But it's lovely, you know, and it creates community and people communicate about that. But wherever we go, try to offer that practice and that prayer. And it, for me, while I'm watching the news, I'm sitting, but I'm also very up and doing stuff a lot with it running. But, you know, I'm an active meditator, and it's kind of taught me how to do it in life instead of expecting the conditions, oh, the cushion has to be just so, and the light has to, and then the smell has to be, and there can't be any noise outside, and, you know, it's... If you integrate that into your practice, I mean, it's a path. I mean, and I have done the sitting stuff. But, you know, it's also good just to integrate it into your everyday life. Let the mantra be, let the prayers be, let a phrase of the prayers be. And it charges the atmosphere with that vibration. Whenever I go into the school, you know, there's some days that I don't necessarily want to go and face, you know, 18 sets of eyes expecting something. But, you know, I cross the threshold into the building, Bismillah. I cross the threshold into the doorway, Bismillah. I'm all the way saying, help give me the energy and the light and what it is now. You know, bring it through so that I can offer it to others. It's like, you know, maybe the limited self doesn't feel like it, but if I can let myself be an instrument, something wonderful can happen and I can give something wonderful. Sometimes I go home and tell Joe, if you really love me, don't talk to me or ask me one question. I'm talked out. Just be. We'll talk on the weekend. He's really a good person to, he understands. What do we learn from Sufism? Murshid says, we learn in Sufism that mysticism, which teaches us how to collect fuel, which is necessary not only for the body, but the mind and the soul. Even the negative energy from the news can be a form of just pure energy. You know, it's our idea whether it's our fuel or it's going to create smoke. You see there? I used to do a lot of sweat lodges years and years ago, practically every weekend. And the person that I studied with, she said, if you're suffering here and it's too hot, you're not praying hard enough. There it is, right? Pray harder. By concentration, these are Murshid's words, he's still answering, what do we learn from Sufism? By concentration, by meditation, by all ways of contemplative practice, the purpose accomplished by the Sufi is that purpose which is the longing of every soul. It's like the doctor said to Mother, where thought goes, form follows. What are you thinking? What's occupying the mind? Practices every day, and sometimes you don't feel like doing them. It's like a dancer who still does the stretching and the moving every day, or the pianist that does the scales every day. And sometimes it's a good day, and sometimes it's not a good day, and sometimes the concentration goods, and sometimes it's not good. But you know what? It's a good barometer to watch where you are on that scale. And everybody's perfect where they are, and you if you have spiritual sustenance coming into your life, that's great. If you think this might be your path, take the step. Right? It's a leap, but it's worth it. But I wouldn't advise doing it unless you're really sure, because it's a marriage that can't be unbroken, even if you think you're walking away. And one doesn't have to, I mean, I'm still consider myself Catholic, and I'm still a practicing Buddhist. There's one, I'm not advising that for everyone, because I think it can be confusing. The theology or the doctrine can be different in some way, but at one point you start to see that it's all that one truth, like the universal worship. It's like the story of Murshid, there were myriads of Murshids, students of Murshids, who, it's always said, the question's always asked in initiation, will you take the teachings given to you as your sacred trust? Part of that is not about comparing with others. You know, it's like Murshid may have said, this is, like for a student, you really need to eat chocolate, and it's going to be very good for you, it'll be give good flavor, and there'll be sweetness, and that will come through your character. And for the other person, that he may say, you absolutely cannot eat chocolate. Well, you can imagine how confusing that would be if the two of them start to talk. Well, Murshid said this. Well, no, he didn't. He said this. Oh, he told me this. And then, to confuse things, it's better to keep a secret. Murshid has all these teachings about knowing how to keep a secret. One sees people in whom the divine spark of light is more or less extinguished, and who still live an apparent virtuous life. This is a kind of statement question of a student. Murshid's answer, an apparent virtuous life is something different. Right living, in my sense, is not only virtuous living. Right living has a still deeper meaning. For what I call right life is the first step to that which is called true life. The third step is truth itself. The mystics say there are three steps to the goal: right life, true life, and truth. You have to ask, what is my truth? Not what does someone think my truth is, or what will they think if that's my truth, It's ours. It's our purpose. It's our goal. It's our gift. That's when one can think. It's our gift. Our being is our gift to the world. The mystics say that there are three steps to the goal: right life, true life, and truth. A person who loves to live a right life and tries to do it, even if he's not contemplative, or meditative, or a religious person must certainly arrive at that high stage, at that goal, which is the ideal goal for which every person there is truth. And the seeking of us, of each individual, is truth. Therefore, right living helps him to realize truth. Right living helps us realize truth. And then remember that in one of the earlier days, someone asked Moshe, what's right living? And he answered it kind of in a circular fashion. What's right for you? What's right for you? I think I want to get through these and then I want to work with the sets of practices that we've been doing. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Your tension good still? Mm-hmm. You're awake? Okay. Murshid goes on to say, if I were to interpret the words of Christ, straight is the gate and narrow is the way, I would say that there is a path in life, a path of going straight, and that path is like walking upon a wire. You've heard that expression, it's like the razor's edge. In the circus, they make a show of it. It is exactly the picture. At every step one takes, there is a fear of falling either to one side or the other. Have you been incapacitated with indecision? I can't decide if that's ever happened or not.
Sitting on a fence.
A piece of advice from my mother's mother. Sometimes I was indecisive. I hate to tell you often about boyfriends. Like, should I go with that one or that one? And my grandmother would always say, because that can be quite a deal, you know, if you have some choices. I was very picky. It was hard. I'm hard on people. Those of you closest to me know that I can do that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm getting softer in my old age, I think. Raheem whispers, is she? What was she like before I met her? But my grandmother Anne always said, you know, it is always better to make a decision than no decision at all. If you make a wrong decision, at least you learn from it. And usually in life you can change it. Can take life another course. And that's a little bit significant. Murshid kind of talks about that in this paper too. But indecision can be absolutely paralyzing, and it can prevent us from any kind of movement. And when we're not moving, you know, even we know that in our body, you know, what it can create. When you can't decide on something, meditate on the situation and watch your breath. If it's in the left nostril, it may be an indication to wait. If it's in the right nostril, it may be an indication to move forward. Your breath can help you. Become a friend with it. Observe the breath. So Murshid goes on to talk about these circus fellows and women that are walking on the wire and they're afraid. Haven't you found it true that if you're walking on a path and all of a sudden you start thinking about if you're going to fall on something, you trip? Mm-hmm. Doesn't that happen? Mm-hmm. I think you all know that I used to live in the high Himalayan mountains, and there were these, you know, if I wanted to go to Dharamsala from McLeod Ganj, I could take the road like this that would take, oh my God, so long to walk. And very dangerous, narrow roads with lots of vehicles on them. And then, or I could take what was called the footway, which went down. And they were often, they were well traveled, but in certain times of year, the pine needles from the would drop on them, and they become very slippery. And as soon as I started to think about it, I would lose my balance. And then I thought, no, I have to really, you know, I'm like a goat, and I would be okay, you know. And you also can walk like this, you know, and get down, or like this. But as soon as I became self-conscious, it's like in the turn, right? Has anyone been turning and it's like, oh, I'm doing this right. Oh. Oh, I'm so into this. Oh. As soon as we start to think about it, we get wobbly.
Even climbing steps.
Yeah, you can trip on them or whatever, right?
Stumble is so complex what you're doing, and it works unconsciously.
Yeah. So we want to... Abandon that fear. So he talks about in India there are jugglers that even make a picture of it. He says they take two very light bamboo sticks and they tie a rope to the top of them. A juggler stands on the rope and holds a brass tray. Okay. And while he's traveling, now just think about this as life. You're walking on this rope and you're carrying this brass tray, right? These are all the circumstances of life, right? And as he goes on, a brass tray, and his task is to go from one point to another. That could be in a day cycle, a year cycle, whatever. You know, this is life. This is moment to moment, right? We're kind of juggling, isn't it true? Especially in our contemporary living. And then he says, while he's traveling, his colleagues, his companions, his friends, whatever, they're below beating drums and singing horrible songs in order to distract his mind. It's just like life, isn't it? It's kind of it's like a Fellini film a little bit.
Sounds like last night.
Yeah, I often tell people when they come to Sufi camp for the first time, have you seen Fellini films? It's a little bit like that. You never know what you're going to encounter, you know? So all the while, you know, they're walking with this brass tray, trying not to drop it, and there's all these distractions. It's a beautiful metaphor. And then he says he has to keep his concentration and secure his balance in spite of all the music calling from below. That is the picture of right living, he says.
Or like sailing. We're not near the, I'm just living in the Northwest. Sailing. Boat. With the wind.
Yeah. Catching
it. How to get back on the rope, because I'll be falling all the time.
No, have confidence, self-confidence. I can do it. My friend, I feel so blessed to have known her all these years. She's one of the trustees of the teachings of Sri Aurobindo, and she lives in Delhi. She's a very well-respected Indian singer, Class A. Indian singer. She's someone that was the dean of music at the University of Agra and then thought she would renounce her position so that she could go to the ashram and just sing her music. Well, guess what? They made her a business person for the, because she had that capacity for business, and she had to get renounce her. She did renounce. She renounced. Had to renounce her music, and she's taking it up again now. Of course, but you know, we don't know. And they always say, "Be careful what you ask for; you might get it." Right living, and you don't look down. Look out on the horizon. Let that be your goal always. The goal is before you. Now, I wanted to read something here. I made a note for myself so I wouldn't forget. So this came this morning. It's very timely for me in my life. Interesting challenges buzz all around. You know, you give out these teachings and then it's like your life starts to test you, you know. So here was the message. This is from the mother. She was the spiritual partner of Aurobindo. She lived longer than him and continued giving teachings at the ashram. And she lived in Pondicherry. But here's the question that was asked. And this relates to the juggling, right? So many problems have been facing me of late. I wonder how they are to be solved happily. So the question, so many problems have been facing me of late. I wonder, how are they to be solved happily? And her answer is, the only way to a true and lasting happiness is a complete and exclusive reliance on divine's grace. That's our surrender that we were talking about. Or there was another word that we used on the first day. I can't remember. It wasn't surrender, but do you remember, Hassan? You had another word that you gave to us. But, you know, just I kept thinking that day, actually, of this haiku that said, the grasses fall, they lay. Would that be right? Or lie?
They lie.
They lie as they fall. The grasses fall, they lie as they fall. It's like that gracious surrender.
It seems like what I ought to surrender, and I don't like doing ought as much.
Yeah. Yeah.
That accompanies the task at hand, because I could go into it like going whoopee, or I could go into it going whoopee.
Yeah.
So I think that would be the burden I would lay down before I go.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's true, and also understanding that it, you know, Mercia just indicated about balance in life. The breath gives us balance, routine in life. You know, I always. When people have troubles, I always ask, are you sleeping regularly? Are you eating regularly? Are you exercising regularly? Are you doing your practices regularly? That creates balance and rhythm. And Mercia talks about this a lot throughout the teachings, that balance and rhythm are very key. And that could be just working with our breath practices. And the Wazifa help us if we use them with the breath to help regulate that rhythm. It sounds like it's impossible that that could change everything, but it really does. So the only way to a true and lasting happiness is a complete and exclusive reliance on divine grace. So even when the worst of the worst could happen, is there some grace in that? Is there something we're learning? And believe me, I mean, I've heard it. I mean, we've all experienced it. You know, I've witnessed it, you know, or I've lived it. I understand. And, you know, I throw myself under the bus purposefully because I'm interested in my survival skills. I do. I don't look away from things that upset me. I look at them. You know, I look at them and I allow myself to be encounter difficult people to see how much capacity I have to love in the face of that. Mm-hmm. And I go to places where people are poor and wounded, and you know, the Tibetan stories that I carry in my heart of terrible, inhumane treatment that a being endures because they love a path or they have a loyalty to a being. You know, 3 years imprisonment automatically if you're caught with Dalai Lama's picture. And not just 3 years imprisonment, 3 years of humiliation, of beatings, of torture, of starvation, of defacing the things that are most precious to you. It's unbelievable.
Hard labor.
I remember one time I was with these nuns and we were doing, were you there, Karimagita? We were doing the practice of chant, where you're imagining, it's a very challenging practice because you imagine chopping your own body up and offering it for other beings. And I remember looking at them because, you know, some traditions we cover our arms. In Buddhism, you don't cover your arms. It's really, you know, it's spiritual to be uncovered. So they had, I could see, and they have, you know, sort of V-necked vestments and robes. And so I could see that this, on several of them, these things that were, it was either bad chicken pox or it was burns. And I asked, may I ask what happened to you? And they said, well, this was one of the forms of torture that we endured. The guards would put out their cigarettes on our skin. And I said, how did you survive? And they said, we prayed for them because we couldn't imagine how they could torture us by day and go home to their wives and girl children and kiss them to go to bed. That conflict must have been terrible for them. And they somehow knew, you know, that the soldiers had to do that, and the prisoners were forced to do that to each other, or they would even endure a worse punishment. So, you know, it was all part of a really mean system. It's going on today, and we don't hear about that on the news. But they had compassion, you know, and that those people, some of them have spent decades enduring this and still just kept trying to have compassion for those people that were treating them so badly and torturing them and demeaning them in every possible way. And I think, gosh, if they can do that, I can too. I can try at least. So the other thing that came up that I want to share, it's a lot of reading. Are you okay with it? Am I keeping your attention? I hope so. Was this other reading, I want to thank you, Guyon. I've already put this book to good use. I have it. I put it above. I have a little ledge above my head. I put it up there with all my computer stuff, too. It's there. That I've kept it near me. And so as I said, a situation has been made evident to me, and I'm sort of going through a process, and it's like, okay, what's the other side of that? What could be the upside of that thing? You know, and I'm trying to look at it, and it's like, where's the divine grace? Where's the divine blessing? What's behind this? Am I going to get stuck on this one thing, or is something else emerging, and I have to be patient and wait and see. And so I kind of did this. It's like, what's the answer? Yeah, can I please receive some inspiration today? And I opened it up to this. Rebounding. And this is from Murshid Neil Douglas Klotz's book, Sadi. It's called The Sufi Book of Life. I guess it's been out for a while. I never had a copy, so thank you so much for bringing it to me. And the wazifa, or the sacred name, is Qayyum. Qayyum. Qayyum means the ever-living. And so he has a description here, and it is said, These are such handy little tools. Thank you. When you are guided to this pathway, feel the rebound of reality with a capital R that allows you to pick yourself up and come to standing again. So if you're on that tightrope and you have your tray and you happen to fall off, can you flip and be upright? Can you rebound?
Why not?
Indeed. Just right oneself, you know, right oneself. Or as Rashida Vera used to say, when the going gets rough, the tough get going. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just go on, you know. She was another one, you know, it's like, get going. Sometimes we get knocked down by something that happens. For instance, the breakup of a relationship. And then feel an inner rebound, a second wind that keeps us going. Jesus at the end of the Beatitudes, in parentheses, or blessed are, in parentheses, says, as viewed from the Aramaic language, recommends that his students consciously use the path of rebound. He tells them, when others direct insults and defamation toward them, they should use the energy behind it to propel them further on their path. It's fuel. Don't let it be smoke. Let it be fuel. I'm going to take that energy and I'm going to clean out that closet. I'm going to rake the yard. I'm going to vacuum the floor. You know, I'm going to do something. Do something different. How great is that? Jesus recommends that his students consciously use the path of rebound. He tells them when others direct insults or defamation toward them, they should use the energy behind it. The energy. Not focus on, oh, they said this and they said that. And can you believe they said this and they said that? What do you think about that? I mean, aren't they terrible people because they said that? And I don't think I'm like that, do you? No. He says, I only can say it because I know it, you know. I've been there. He tells them when others direct insults and defamation toward them, they should use the energy behind it to propel them on their path. Jesus recommends, go further. Do everything extreme, including letting your ego disappear. Your greater universe of life opens around you from the blows on your heart. Thank you. When people do that, thank them for the extra energy. I mean, imagine people are talking trash about you. You have a lot of power in their life that they want to spend energy talking about you.